This episode of the UAV Digest is sponsored by Go Engineer, provider of design, engineering, and 3D printing solutions for the aerospace and unmanned vehicles industries. To learn more, visit theuavdigest.com/goengineer. And by UAV Propulsion Tech, a provider of propulsion, servo, autopilots, and rescue and recovery parachute solutions for the unmanned aerial vehicle market. For more information, check out www.uavpropulsiontech.com. You're listening to episode 86 of the UAV Digest. I'm Max Flight in Hartford, Connecticut.
And I'm David Vanderhoof in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Hey, Max, how's the weather up in Hartford? It's the first day of spring tomorrow when we're going to get 3 to 6 inches of snow here in Philadelphia.
Yeah, I know. It's going to be a mess. Not looking forward to it at all. Getting ready to take a little bit of a road trip. And I think we'll be driving into it rather than away from it. So we'll see what happens.
And luckily tonight, folks, just so you know, if my voice goes hoarse, it doesn't matter because we've got two fabulous guests to talk about a topic that we've talked about a lot over the last year and a half, which is sense in a void.
Yes, this is obviously a technology that is important to the commercialization of drones. And we're really pleased to have joining us first Greg Lukens. He's the Vice President of Business Development for Dual Electronics Corp. Dual manufactures aviation GPS and ADS-B receivers. Greg's an engineer and entrepreneur and a licensed pilot. Greg, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. Excited to be here.
So which do you enjoy more, flying or engineering or creating businesses?
Just the combination of all of them. Who doesn't like flying other than my wife? But I get her up there and she enjoys it afterwards. It's fun. It's just we take new opportunities and put them together and make them useful, make them businesses.
That's great. Also joining us is Brian Scott. He's the founder and principal of Arclarity. Arclarity is a developer of 3D augmented reality aviation systems. Brian, you're also a private pilot and an engineer, aren't you?
I am that as well.
How long ago was Arclarity founded?
So Arclarity was founded in 2013. Both myself and the other principal, William Lubke, worked for a large defense contractor and realized that we had a greater calling and wanted to solve problems that impassioned us. So we decided to take the risk and the leap of faith. And 2 years later, here we are. And I couldn't be more happy.
Fantastic. Greg, Dual has been around, an awful long time.
It has. Dual is a 50-year-old company. We have a heritage in car audio, actually. And we've brought that into the aviation world in the last, probably within the last 5 years.
All right. Well, many of you are probably wondering, why do we have these two guys here? It's because Dual and Arclarity have teamed up to develop, as David mentions, a sense and avoid solution for autonomously flying drones. So, David, are you about ready to have a great conversation on that topic?
I am. And you know what the best part about this conversation is going to be? For all of our pilot haters that don't like UAVs, here are two pilots that are actually helping to solve the problem. So it's even better. You guys even have better bona fides for our listeners because we have a large pilot population that are really fearful of UAVs and the inevitable one that's going to take out a 747 over a major city. So I'm really looking forward to this conversation and the technology and the passion that you guys are going to bring to it, like that we've heard exchanging emails with you guys over the last couple of weeks.
All right. Well, why don't we get started, David? Maybe we can first ask Greg and Brian, what was the motivation for these two companies to get together and develop sense and avoid technology?
So that's an interesting story. Arc Clarity was developing an immersive navigation capability, which utilized GPS and ADS-B. And as a private pilot, I was already using dual products in the cockpit. So it was a natural choice to reach out. And Greg responded with enthusiasm and interest as to what we were developing. We arranged a meeting and started brainstorming and a discussion and got on the topic of drones and sense in a void. And before we knew it, we were hashing out possibilities and solutions and quickly recognized that there was quite a bit of synergy there, so much so that we couldn't ignore it.
David, I liked what you said before about sort of the instant credibility of having people with manned aviation background taking a look at this issue, because it becomes, you know, not so much just purely a theoretical exercise, but maybe more of a practical exercise. Greg, would you say that's the case?
Yes, and it's actually funny that David brings that up, because it's something that I've been paying attention to a lot lately. When I first got my pilot's license, that was the genesis for me sort of paying attention to what was around me and above me. And as we started looking at sense in a void with drones, I started really paying attention to what was happening in the airspace around me. And I was looking at the FAA maps, and it's remarkable. Within 30 miles of where we're located, we have multiple seaplane bases. So we've got low-flying aircraft. We have a parachuting school. We've got a hang gliding school. We have FAA-restricted airspaces. We apparently have the largest collection of migratory bald eagles outside of Alaska, I've been told. Hmm. We have landing patterns for Class B and Class C airspaces right above us. We have a permanent TFR over Disney. We have low-flying traffic copters. We've got a new trauma center coming in just around the way with a helipad. And one very crazy Cessna pilot who likes to skim the trees every Thursday morning. So there's, you put all this together and you quickly realize there's a lot you can bump into up there.
Greg, you're bringing up an interesting point, and maybe we're jumping a little ahead in the conversation, but I think it's a good way to talk about it. Is so you're thinking that the sense and avoid technology that you're going to develop for UAVs or drones might roll back into manned aviation?
That's an interesting question. Don't know that I have a good answer to that at this point. There are obviously technologies for assisting pilots, TCAS, and things like that. But our focus really here is enabling a drone with sense in a void, because that if we can get them to operate safely in flight, that ultimately is going to increase their commercial value. So we're looking at the long haul. We sort of divide things up. It's the long haul and the short haul. The long haul is the drone from takeoff to kind of over top of its landing spot. And then the short haul would be getting it down onto the ground where it needs to ultimately terminate its flight. But we look at the long haul as participating in the national airspace. And that to us is where the drones really start to develop their value. Once they can operate autonomously and safely, the value of the drone really, really starts to expand.
Greg, maybe we should kind of define the scope of this a little bit, because when we think about drones, of course, there's everything from large, high altitude down to, you know, small hobbyist sized drones. What are we looking at here?
Our focus is on the sort of prosumer hobbyist type drone, a drone that could be useful for limited commercial purposes, someone who's going to be filming, for example, or doing short flights over agriculture, that kind of thing, all the way up to a drone that is going to be in the air a little bit longer. It's we're not going after the something that the defense contractor is going to come up with. That's a whole different ball of wax. But we're looking at the prosumer and the commercial, light commercial market.
Brian, isn't that, I would say that's great, because that's, I think, where a lot of the action is these days, certainly, as we read in the press all the time. But one aspect of that, Brian, is isn't that also at the same time maybe kind of the harder size to deal with, because we're concerned with weight and power consumption and things like that in drones of this size?
It absolutely is a challenge. the one thing that we have to be cautious of when we're developing the solution is, you know, any solution that we bring to the drone is going to add weight, it's going to add energy consumption, and if done inappropriately, it's going to reduce the number of missions that any particular drone can handle. And if you take that to the extreme, the drone won't be able to perform any functions, and so you've devalued it completely. So being able to develop a solution that can efficiently handle its mission profiles while maintaining an acceptable level of safety in the air, staying safely separated from traffic, and doing it in an autonomous manner is paramount. But you bring up a good point. The smaller the platform, the more challenges that come to the equation. Hmm.
So do we have a solution or an approach now, or are we earlier in the process and trying to discover an approach that can be commercialized?
We are looking at commercialization in the second half of this year. We have a system. It's pulling information from 3D maps. It has interoperability with electronic sensors. It pulls in data from the ADS-B broadcasts, and it determines how to safely get from point A to point B in a busy airspace. So this is going to be a hardware component that will integrate into the drone and work with its flight control system. In our development, we've sort of had a lot of learnings about how we need to interact with sensors, and we can get into that in a bit. But this is something that's more than just a research project on the R&D table.
That's fantastic. So are you actually testing this right now?
Well, if the FAA is listening, of course not.
Okay. Or testing indoors, maybe?
Exactly.
Okay. Let's talk about the FAA a little bit. We've seen the NPRM is out for the commercial use of small UAS. I think this kind of integrates into the path that the FAA needs to take. Do you agree with that? Are you working with the FAA? What's the relationship with the FAA, if any?
Brian, you want to answer that?
We're not working directly with the FAA yet. I think the NPRM for small UAS is the right approach for the FAA to take. I mean, the alternative is a single omnibus rulemaking, which I don't think would be achievable, and I think everybody agrees. So this NPRM is relatively restrictive. It's designed to be that way. They have to take the safe approach. This is a necessary first step. And I would say that our solution provides benefit even under these line of sight circumstances that are below 500 feet, because I can outline a situation where I can maintain line of sight with a drone, but not be able to see a news helicopter in route, low flight, due to an obscure, maybe a building or some trees or something like that. I could see my drone fine, but a news helicopter could still collide with the drone under these current NPRM. And this solution will directly address situations like that and increase safety.
Maybe can you give us a little more specific detail about how the system works?
Sure. So at the heart of the system is a three-dimensional model of the National Airspace System. And feeding into that model are GPS and ADS-B sensors. There is going to be, and I say going to be because we recognize that these sensors are not going to be sufficient to do sense and avoid in a completely safe manner. We're going to need proximity sensors, and that could be optical or LIDAR or some alternative set of sensors to increase the fidelity of the operational picture that we're developing in this three-dimensional model. So we'll have an open interface to those sensors to be able to feed this model. And as the model's picture increases in fidelity, the sense and avoid, the way we can determine sense and avoid and maintain safely, you know, safe separation from objects in that model grows as well. And I think that, you know, with the onset of drones, this is going to become more important. This is going to be one of the most important aspects of integrating drones in the National Airspace System, because there are going to be a lot more objects in the air.
Now, does that model exist in the hardware or software on the drone?
It will. This model will exist as in the hardware component that we provide. It will continuously run analytics on the current picture that it sees, developing future states, and then making predictions about that future state, and in the cases of collision avoidance, directly interacting with the autopilot to maintain separation.
So I guess my next question to that is, should it interact with the autopilot, and what kind of feedback does the pilot on the ground get?
So the pilot on the ground is going to get a notification via the RF interface that goes back down to the ground station. I think you absolutely have to interact directly with the autopilot. I think it's going to be required in a future NPRM simply because if the FAA ever chooses to ground aircraft, I see them wanting to have a button to be able to ground drones and send out a signal via ADS-B, which our software will receive and ground the drone.
So White House protection.
I can see that. So we can feed the model with whatever we choose to, and if we choose to feed it with with controlled and restrictive airspaces or TFRs via ADS-B, which is a capability, then we can maintain separation from those objects as well.
I think that's an excellent question. I'm sorry for jumping in here. When you look at, as a pilot would, the maps of where you can fly in the restricted airspaces and the various requirements for being in the different airspaces, that's what's getting fed into the drone. So the same sort of situational awareness that a human pilot would have to maintain while flying, based upon the knowledge of reading these maps, this all gets fed into the sensitive void system. So it's operating as much as possible with the same intent to obey the rules and stay out of the spaces that a human pilot would.
Greg, how large and how heavy would this piece of hardware be?
That's an excellent question. This is in the class of drones that we're looking at. Weight matters, size matters, and cost matters. You can't put something on a drone that's going to limit its flight time. That's a major restriction right now in what the drone builders are fighting. How do I get more flight time out of my drone? By the same token, how do I put a sensor suite? How do I put all of this into a drone for a cost point that isn't 20, 30, 40, 50% of the drone or double the drone's price? There's a lot of trade-offs that have to go on here.
And how will this be marketed? Is this something that, that you would be providing to OEMs, or is this something that pilots, operators would be able to add to their existing drones?
We see the drone manufacturers as being the primary market for this. There is a realistic cost for this, and as a hobbyist, you're probably not going to justify the cost. You'll say, okay, I'm going to be a smart operator, I'm going to obey the rules, and you'll manage what the drone to the best of your ability. So it's a drone that's going to operate in the commercial airspace that needs to get along with the rest of the aircraft that are up there and the FAA rules. That's where we see this as the most applicability.
Plus, the OEMs would do all the integration, right? Or maybe in conjunction with you guys, but the operator, the owner, wouldn't have to be involved in that kind of that aspect of it.
True. The best approach would be for the end purchaser of the drone to not have to deal with any of this. The drone would come configured with this system built into it.
Yeah, just buy a complete system and not have to worry about that. Just, you know, worry about the applications, the video, the inspections, and so forth.
Exactly. And to build on something that Brian said earlier, the ability of this to work with multiple sensors, not just GPS and ADS-B, is really something that we'd like to use as an invitation to work with the rest of the industry, particularly the sensor manufacturers. Because if we can make this an easy platform to plug a variety of sensors in so that you can get a suitable suite of electronics to meet your mission profile, then that opens commercial opportunity for everybody and makes the drone more useful in a faster, shorter amount of time.
How about the whole issue of proprietary approaches versus open or shared common approaches to this? Is that an issue here?
So could you elaborate, what do you mean by proprietary versus, you mean open source versus proprietary?
Well, I'm thinking about an industry standard, let's say, approach to sense and avoid. Or do you think that we'll end up seeing a collection of proprietary, proprietary approaches to sense and avoid, so that company A takes this approach, company B takes that approach?
I absolutely think that's what you'll end up seeing. What we hope to see is that while there are, let's say, different approaches to sense and avoid, the interfaces that are used on the drone are common. So we're confident in the capability that we're developing and what we've seen in testing so far, that our sense and avoid solution is definitely going to be able to discriminate itself. But most importantly, that it's going to add safety. And so I think that's what everybody's going to be striving to achieve. What's important is that we're all communicating along the same language, so that you don't have a number of stovepipe solutions that don't interoperate. You want to be able to handle different mission profiles with different sets of sensors and not be tied to one specific profile, so to speak.
That's been something that's become very apparent to us as we've been in the development of this. There's a lot of energy going into sensors of all different kinds, but the integration of these sensors, the sensor has detected something. It needs to report that something to the flight computer, and there needs to be a common way for a variety of different devices to report what an obstacle is. So I think when we look at open versus closed, a definite place where open is beneficial is in a picture of of what an obstacle is. How do we describe an obstacle in a common way so that a sensor can marry up to the flight controller, or in this case, to our sense and avoid system, in an efficient way that allows you to interchange devices and there's a common way for things to communicate.
Fascinating. Where can folks learn more about the work that you guys are doing and the products that are we're expecting to see now in the second half of the year?
You've caught us a little bit ahead of the game. We're working on a more public presentation of this information. There's nothing available at the moment. We'll have that up absolutely soon. And as a matter of fact, you guys would be a great set of people to notify when it's available.
Yes, absolutely. And we'd love to be able to share that with our audience.
So I guess we should do a little bit of breaking news today.
Yeah, David, you slipped something in here that, since I'm sort of in travel status right now, hadn't seen.
Yeah, well, our friends at the FAA released a notification today on their FAA.gov news hub site with the title, Amazon Gets Experimental Airworthiness Certificate. So as a lot of the emails that went through the Twitter space was going around, it looks like Amazon delivery is one step closer, but you then read the requirements and it's pretty restrictive, this experimental airworthiness certificate. It's got to be daylight hours, under 400 feet, line of sight. The main operator must have a pilot's license. And then there's a new twist that I don't think we've seen in any of the other authorizations in the previous, which is, to quote the report, the certificate also requires Amazon to provide monthly data to the FAA. The company must report the number of flights conducted, pilot duty time per flight, unusual hardware or software malfunctions, any deviations from air traffic controller's instructions, any unintended loss of communications or links, and the FAA includes these reporting requirements in all UAS experimental airworthy certificates. But I don't ever remember seeing the report back monthly to some of the other ones that have gone out. So I guess I'll ask her a guess. Is this a little too restrictive for Amazon, or is it the right approach?
It's an interesting thing that you bring up, because I also saw today that the Senator Kelly Ayotte out of New Hampshire is convening a hearing on the 24th to allow the subject is unmanned aircraft systems, key considerations regarding safety, innovation, economic impact, and privacy. Excuse me for stumbling over that. The witnesses in the hearing are actually including Paul Meisner, who's the VP of Global Public Policy for Amazon. So it's going to be an opportunity for Amazon to sit down with the FAA and the NTIA and Congress, and they'll have their chance to say whether it's too restrictive or not. I mean, you're going to hear what they have to say.
I don't know. I think AI is just trying to prevent A-10 squadrons to become Reaper squadrons. But that's just a sideline, being the military aircraft geek that I am.
Could you use A-10s to deliver packages? Is that...
There's a lot of wing there. If you're going to carry them via drone externally, you could carry them via A-10. But yeah, it's interesting. It's really not an authorization. Well, I guess they're trying to differentiate between commercial use and an authorization to do commercial use and an experimental airworthiness certificate, which is more along the lines of an aircraft requirement that you would get from EAA than you would for a drone. So it's an interesting approach they're taking with Amazon, which might make Amazon a little cranky.
But, it seems that you can't undertake any significant, volume of package delivery without having a sense and avoid solution as part of that. Isolated deliveries here or there in an emergency situation is one thing. But if you're going to run a business based on delivery of packages by drone the way that Amazon is suggesting, they have to have that technology, don't they?
I would say absolutely.
Absolutely.
Yeah. If you look at historically across mid-air collisions in manned aircraft, those typically occur during daylight hours, during VMC, or visual meteorological conditions, and 80% are below 3,000 feet. So, I think the space where these drones are operating is historically, is going to be a dangerous space without sense and avoid. And as a manned pilot, we're constantly vigilant of other air traffic. So to neglect that with a drone would, I just don't see how it could work.
Yeah, yeah.
The FAA is very sensitive to risk, obviously. And when we start looking at rural applications, we've got drones up doing agricultural inspections or whatnot. Not a whole lot of population for parts to rain down on, but if you're doing delivery of packages, it's a whole different ballgame. You've got a congested area, both in things that are flying around and people underneath you.
Well, and obstacles in the airspace that you're flying. If you're going to be delivering drones downtown in New York, there's a lot of obstacles to sense and avoid.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And there's been a lot of energy going into these short range sensors. I mean, the list of companies and universities is as long as your arm. But and that's great, because we need to be able to differentiate telephone poles from trees to the difference between your sidewalk and your flower bed. People are going to get very upset if their daisies get crushed by their delivery package. But this is something that we've recognized is going to be an integral part to the overall sense and avoid solution. We've chosen to take a look at the long haul solution, or the long haul section first, but keep a very keen eye on being able to integrate a shorter range sensor, because the problem space is similar. It just becomes on a smaller scale.
We have, and I guess since we had a breaking news, we should talk about the other FAA news this week. This is the all FAA network all the week, all the time. and this was from motherboard.vice.com. FAA says you can't post drone videos on YouTube.
Yeah,
this was an eye-opening experience for a lot of people.
So an aviation safety inspector in the FAA's Tampa office apparently believes that posting video from a drone on YouTube constitutes commercial use. Why? Well, because YouTube has advertisements. We also see in this article that the FAA inspector was responding to a complaint, which, I don't know, it makes me think there's kind of maybe a little bit more to this, but I don't know. It doesn't seem like the inspector made the or took the proper view here.
I don't know. Our guests, you have any input? Have you guys figured out the answer of what commercial is yet?
That's a $64,000 question, isn't it?
If you ask the FAA, commercial would probably, or they would probably define commercial as using the drone for commerce. So I can take a pack. I can deliver packages within my company using drones under the current proposed NPRM and be completely within the regulation or the proposed regulation. But I could not stand up a company to do the exact same thing and charge for it. And I think that's what the FAA is using here, is the fact that you can't get paid, you know, to do this right now.
It does seem a little odd that they were to have singled out this application. There's not a lot of money that's traded hands. And you're right, the article did sort of point to a notification from a potential competitor as to why the FAA paid attention to this. And, you know, I guess you could also take a look at it and say, is this drone being operated in a safe capacity over crowds? And you know, are there any improper piloting going on? But again, that wasn't, like you said, the reason for the letter. The reason for the letter was you're making money off advertising. And that's a very interesting gray area.
Which, Max, we better be careful. The FAA might nag this podcast for cease and desist as a commercial endeavor about UAVs.
Yeah, well, we're not flying, at least not right now. All right, well, we've got an interesting video of the week. This was actually uncovered by Drone Mama, and this is from the Daily Mail in the UK. It's sheer cliffs, dense jungle, and its own climate. Mesmerizing drone footage captures haunting beauty of the world's largest cave. Oh, this is really, really, I mean, we've had spectacular videos taken from drones in the past, but this is really something amazing. This is the Hang Son Dong Cave in Vietnam, and it's a spectacular video. Did you take a look at this, David?
I did. It's pretty phenomenal, and it's in high def, and you just sort of let yourself wander and go, wow, I could be someplace like this and not sitting at my desk in the office. Oh, did I didn't say that, did I? But yeah, no, it's definitely worth the video. And of course, we'd like to thank Drone Mama for all she does for the show. And finding a video of the week like this is pretty cool.
All right, David, how about some feedback from our audience?
Boy, do we get a lot of feedback, folks. And, you know, we try to answer everything. But Sam from Australia said, I've been listening to the podcast for a while now. Just thought you might find this mob interest. And we'll put a link to the show note. It's a UAV company called Sky Futures down in Australia. But also, I know you're right, caught up with the NPRM. But in the U.S., but in Australia, had come and gone earlier last year. And it was entirely to deregulate all SUAS is below 200 kilograms, outside of CTA under 400 AGL. The only ones who knew about it were the established operators, so they all were opposed to it because they had to go through the whole licensing process and didn't want anyone to get a free ride. Anyway, it's been 6 months past the due date for the actual rules to be published, with nothing heard from CASA, their FAA, and just thought you might find it interesting. So Australia is evidently having some, they're trying to be the bleeding edge, but they seem to be falling behind. And in reference to last week's episode with Bill English from the National Transportation Safety Board, we got a tweet from at Little Miss Sunshine, which was, at UAV Digest, if you keep having guests of this quality, you will need to make the show longer to allow for listing their credentials. Well, you know, that's why we have guests like we have tonight. They make our show really good, and we look forward to bringing them to you and bringing you aspects of the that you won't normally see on Twitter or Facebook or all the other places you do your drone research. So I think we're trying to do a good job. And so, guys, have you had a good time doing the show tonight?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I'm glad that our list of credentials was short enough to make it on the episode tonight.
Yeah. We've got more. We'll put those in the show notes for sure. But David, I have an update on the count of the number of comments received for the NPRM.
I'll pretend that we're doing a drum roll right now, and the count is as of today, March 19th, 2015.
1,097 comments received.
Wow. What's the date it expires?
April 25th, I believe.
So, and of course, folks, if you haven't read the NPRM yet, you can go to our homepage, which is the UAVdigest.com, and you can click on the link and it'll take you directly to the document. You can read the document. And of course, Max and I want to encourage everyone to go through and read the document, read it all the way through first before you put your comments in. And we want a lot of comments, but we want substantive comments that will help the FAA come up with even better regulations. You guys, have you guys put in any comments yet?
Not yet, but we will.
All right, very good. Well, David, I think that'll do it for this episode of the UAV Digest. We really want to thank our guests, Greg Lukens from Adul and Brian Scott from Our Clarity. Guys, thanks again.
It was a pleasure to be here.
Our pleasure. Thank you so much for having us on.
You can find us at the UAVdigest.com. If you'd like to go straight to the show notes for this episode, you can use the shortcut, the UAVdigest.com/86. If you'd like to write us, the email address is feedback@theUAVdigest.com. David, where else can they find us?
And, of course, we're on Twitter, which is at UAV Digest. And I posted a tweet tonight. You might have to hunt for it for when you hear this. But of Max recording in his remote studio, followed by a pillow fight. And, of course, we have a Facebook page, which is facebook.com/theUAVdigest. And if you'd like to leave us we really would appreciate you leaving feedback to iTunes. That helps people find us. Likewise, if you stream it to your phone via Stitcher, we'd like that. If you'd like to purchase some UAV Digest swag to promote our industry, you can go to cafepress.com/theUAVdigest. Or if you'd like to sponsor our little endeavor, you can become a patron at patreon.com/theUAVdigest. And of course, both of those have links on our homepage, so you can easily find our patron page and our Cafe Price page. So on that, I guess we should again thank our guests, and hopefully you guys will come back in the future when you have other developments. We'd like to stay in touch with you folks.
Absolutely. We'd love to.
So on that, this is David in Philly.
And Max in Hartford.
Thanks for listening, everyone.